is what the Renaissance was about, between the mind and the heart. Balance. We've gone all into the mind and we've got to rebalance to the heart.
Welcome to the Behind the Scenes podcast. This is Michael Golab. Today I'm talking to Patsy Rodenberg. Patsy Rodenberg, OBE, is recognized as one of the world's leading voice teachers and coaches, and also as a renowned authority on Shakespeare. We talk about how storytelling has made us human, the immense power of saying, I don't know, the importance of generosity, the significance of realizing that you're more powerful than you think you are, the importance of working on yourself, how creating a safe space boosts everyone's creativity, the crucial moment of defining what success means for you specifically, the important skill of absolutely loving the journey, and so much more. Patsy's worked regularly with the best-known actors of British theatre, including Dame Judi Dench, Sir Ian McKellen and Daniel Day-Lewis, as well as many of the biggest stars of film and television, including Nicole Kidman, Daniel Craig, Orlando Bloom, Hugh Jackman and Natalie Portman. She's worked with theatre companies all around the world. Some of these include the National Theatre, the RSC, the Moscow Art Theatre, Complicité, Cheek by Jowl and Comédie Française. Patsy's authored several books on the subjects of voice coaching, including Speaking Shakespeare, The Right to Speak, The Need for Words, The Actor Speaks, The Second Circle, and Power Presentation. And now I bring you Patsy Rodenberg.
Hi, Patsy.
Hi, how are you, Michael?
I'm very well, how are you?
Good.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
I'm so delighted. I love your acting, Michael. So I'm doing it because I respect you as an artist.
Oh, that's very kind of you. My very first question would be, what do you love the most about being a voice coach and a director?
That's quite a long answer. I suppose a lot of us go into a field because we have a fear of it. I started in voice because I couldn't speak. So I feel that I had a vocation. I don't feel that I could have done anything else. I had to find out about my own voice. And I've always loved poetry and Shakespeare. As a child, I came from a household with no books, so I didn't have educated people around me. But when I was very young, I found an old battered copy of a poetry book, which I've still got, which was my mother's, and Shakespeare. And without having all the academics telling me I couldn't understand Shakespeare, I understood Shakespeare. I didn't understand it all.
Yeah.
But the first thing I read was Hamlet. And it was extraordinary because I thought, wow, it starts with a ghost. So my journey has been one of vocation, not of choice. In the journey of discovering my own voice, going to Central, teaching when I was at Central in Holloway Prison, which was a ferocious woman's prison, because I needed to make money. I had a sort of epiphany there because I thought, in a way, they have lost their voices. They could speak, but they had no political power, their voice. So it became very clear to me that this was my journey. And it is extraordinarily wonderful because people release themselves. In my work, I don't put on a voice. I empower. I try and find your voice, hidden under all the habits. We all have these amazing natural voices. We're all fully present. And then we lose them. So I don't... To find an actor's authentic voice, you have to find their centered body and their breath system.
So what I hear is that you love empowering people. Is that what you love the most?
Yes, I think what I really feel very strongly is that more important than the taming of fire, more important than the invention of the wheel, the human's ability to tell each other stories is the unique thing. An actor telling a story is the highest level of storytelling. But I know in my heart, and some anthropologists will disagree and some might agree, that the idea of a community sharing stories not only educates and gave the human species an edge on the planet.
Yeah.
That is probably why they carried the elderly, because the elderly have stories of, actually, there's a waterhole we once visited 30 years ago, and it will save. So, but more importantly, and this is my real passion, is that the great storytelling is about how to be a decent human being. So every great play is about the struggle between the misuse of power and not using power. Every great play at its center is about love. Is this conditional love? Is it unconditional love? And at the center of every great story all over the planet, there is a thing called justice. Is this man-made justice? Is the law right or is the law wrong? Now, every story, and I've been lucky enough to teach all over the world with indigenous people, all the stories have these essences in. So my passion is not only to empower a voice, but to empower people's stories.
So the reason why stories are important is because they teach us.
They teach us, they can entertain us, of course they should. Yeah. They should thrill us, which is why I think that every actor should have they should stretch and have a thrilling voice. You can't go to the theatre and not hear them. You've got to be thrilled. You know, otherwise, I think at the moment theatre's trying to do film on stage, but that's not the point. The actor has to be fully present. They have to thrill us. But a great story entertains us, educates us, but contains our moral centre. It is a moral debate. Who are we? And what has happened, you know, I'm going to talk historically. My son always moans about me saying I tell him too much history, so you can stop me. But I think something extraordinary happened in the 1980s, because the thing about a great actor is that they're generous. A great artist is generous.
Mm.
That doesn't mean to say they're not tough. It's not being sentimental.
Yeah.
It's being generous. But people have been mean and greedy, because the opposite of generosity is meanness and greed. Throughout history, ancient history, there's always been people, but it was never rewarded. It was in Shakespeare's play, when you're found out that you're a liar and you're mean and greedy, it's not good. In the 1980s, it became fashionable to be greedy and narcissistic, and that's when the theatre ensemble disappeared. The ensemble is about a community of people. You don't have to like each other. I think young students get this silly idea that working together, you've all got to like each other. No, you've got to be present with each other in a safe space to be creative. And the agreement is we are serving a play. And if we serve a play and you're a messenger and you come on, the company gives you leadership, because that message is important. So it's a sharing of leadership. Obviously, there are some actors who are more important, but now we have actors who don't even want to be in a community, who don't want to be in an ensemble. So we have a situation which is destroying the essence of theatre, which is ensemble storytelling.
Yeah, I feel like with generosity in life or on stage or in theatre and art, it's got to do with people not thinking long-term enough, but short-term. So if I think that I'm never going to see this person again, it's easier to steal something from them, to abuse them, to treat them badly. But if I know that it's going to come back to me in the end...
And it will.
And it will. And there's nothing esoteric about it. It might be esoteric, but I think it's wonderful to just think, how can we create the greatest thing long term and not just quick term effect? And yeah, so... Yeah, that made me think of that now.
But you see, what's wonderful about a theatre ensemble is that it's a community serving something. By the way, I say this to the top world leaders. You have to serve the company, not yourself. And now I'm...
Because in the end, you will serve yourself by serving the company. Yeah, it comes.
But that's what ensemble and community knows. And the other thing that I'm talking about all the time, we've got to be now generous to nature. Because we've taken and taken. You know my presence work. My presence work is to find our presence. And when we're together, it's give and take. You take by listening. You give by speaking clearly. And we lose that when we don't, if one person thinks they're more important. And this idea that I'm coming round back to, because I didn't explain it clearly enough before. You see, we don't have to like each other to serve something. Yeah. You know, I have to say to actors, look, you can do the best work in your career, but the audience might not like you. You can't control certain things. And I think that's, when I was young, I feel very much for young people because I didn't have this idea that, you know, you have to be liked. Yeah. We all want to be liked, but it's awful for young people. I didn't also have the idea that you have to have perfection. You see, perfection, any artist knows that perfection does not exist. We seek it and never get it. The idea that young people are being told this great lie that perfection exists is appalling. We're doing a great disservice to young people.
It also creates a lot of tension when you want to be perfect. You're full of fear and full of tension. I think you speak about it in The Right to Speak, about God doesn't mind a bum note.
God doesn't mind a bum note. And you're going to fail.
Do you want to quickly maybe explain to our listeners what this is about?
This was in the 80s and I was at the Barbican and there was a fantastic gospel choir there. And I had started at that point to work with opera singers, top opera singers. So I was branching out from just actors. And I noticed how precious opera singers are about their voice. In a technical, they can't do a technical, they have to rest, they've got to have days off to do. And I went to see this extraordinary gospel choir, and there was a singer, and she was in her 80s. And what she was doing with her voice was amazing. And I was lucky enough, because I was able to be backstage, because I was working there, that I met her. And I chatted to her, and I think she was quite sweet to me because, you know, I think I was boring her. But I said, my God, your voice, you do anything. And she just went, mm-hmm. And I said, it's amazing, extraordinary. How often do you sing? And she said, 3 times. And I said, 3 times a week? She said, no, 3 times a day. I said, like that? Yes. How many days a week? Oh, 7 days. And I said, wow. And do you ever lose your voice? And she said, no. I said, well, that's extraordinary the way you're using the voice. And she just looked at me and she said, I sing for God. God doesn't mind a bum note. And I had another story I often tell, which is about Nureyev doing the perfect pirouette. And he said, I did one perfect pirouette in my life, and it was in class, and nobody saw it. And we seek something, and occasionally in teaching, you think, you never do a perfect class. You fail in every class. But every now and then you think, oh God, I just got that exercise right. And maybe that's all we can ask.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I feel like this is a great way to go through life and art and anything really, is to not be all tensed up in order to be perfect, because you never will be. You just have to strive to get better at something, but also relax about it. It is what it is.
Well, it's not that simple in a way, because in order to even begin getting there, you know me, I love craft. People are very scared of craft today, but craft releases you. You've got to do the repetition enough so that you forget the work, but you've got to work hard. It doesn't happen by magic.
Oh, yeah, no, that's not what I meant. I meant that you do the work, you do the best you can do, but then you let go. That's what I mean.
Yes,
you release. You don't strive by tension to be perfect.
But then there's a paradox here, because you do have to do a lot of work to even glimpse that. You know, I love Shakespeare. Of course I love Shakespeare, but the fact that he stood in front of an audience interests me a great deal. As an unperfect actor on the stage, who with his fear is put beside his part. Yeah. I love, in Shakespeare's time, unperfect meant uncrafted. Every actor on the planet knows, standing in front of an audience thinking, I'm going to swear now, sorry, I'm just warning you.
That's all right.
Oh, fuck. I wish I'd done more work. I love the fact that Shakespeare was standing on the globe going, oh, fuck, I wish I'd done a bit more work. And then this incredible description, this is Sonnet 23, who with his fear is put beside his part. Every actor knows that sometimes you're standing on stage because you haven't done enough work, you haven't done a deep deep work, deep knowledge, and your part is standing beside you. It should be in you. You should be owning the part, and you're walking on stage with this ghost of your part beside you because of your fear and the fact you haven't done your work.
Mm. What do you find applicable from your work in your daily life?
That's an interesting word, applicable. I think all I know about myself, and this can be very annoying if you're living with me, is that my processes are very thorough. My brain is actually quite a boring place because I'm always thinking about education. Let's just remind people about the root of education, the word, to bring forth what is within. Not to superimpose, not to do the cosmetic. We're too interested in the cosmetic in theatre now. We don't need all these sets. We don't need all these costumes. Because when you have great text and you cover it with concept, you simplify the profound. And you know that I often say to people, do you know you have to do the simple before you do the profound? So many directors, actors want to do the profound before they can do the simple.
Because the simple is not easy. Because people think that simple is easy, yes. But simple is not easy.
No, and we don't get deep knowledge until we do that.
There's this great quote from Richard Feynman, the physicist, where he was so brilliant that he was able to explain his theories in the most simple way. He said, you don't understand something if you can't explain it to a 7-year-old child. It means you don't understand it. So it reminds me of art as well, as if you overcomplicate.
It's all the same. Yeah. There's no difference in any of these processes. The idea that a great scientist is an artist. We are seeking that, but I think what is hard for people in my private life is that I'm passionate about sorting things out, and therefore, believe it or not, I might not be as present as I should be. I teach presence, you know, but I'm worrying about the class. Can I make that better? Can I do this? So I'm very thorough, and that is not necessarily useful, but I'm also thorough in the world I am around me. I think I'm thorough.
Uh-huh.
And that can be very boring.
In what way is it boring?
Because I don't necessarily unplug myself from what I feel I'm doing. I feel that I'm in service to something, which is what a vocation is. So I'm thinking about it. I'm talking about it all the time to myself. I have to prepare. And the other thing that I think you brought up, which was very interesting, which I think is applicable. When you teach well, when you do anything well, there's a cost. There's a tremendous cost. And people don't think that I'm nervous when I go into a classroom. I teach the same class maybe. Of course, it's always different, but the same process for the last 45 years. And people can't believe that I still prepare for that class, which I do. It costs, and it costs because it matters. I was not a very pleasant young child. Not that I was unpleasant. I just thought things mattered. And if you live in a world when things don't seem to matter, that's a hard thing. So it costs. If you care about something, you give it your all. And that might mean that people around me don't have enough of me.
Would you say you have a tendency to ruminate as well, then?
I don't know whether it's ruminating. Because ruminate is much more absent. You know, it's a bit more in reverie. I very presently worry about structures. Should I have done that exercise before that? It's much more embodied. I'm not saying ruminating isn't embodied, but it's much more driving home thinking, God, I think I did that order wrong. No, that went very well. I wonder if I can remember that. So it's this constant seeking of getting structure, getting that nobody can be creative unless the space is safe. And I worry about failures when I haven't kept the space safe. It's my job as the leader, not only with students, but with top people on the planet. It's my job to say, excuse me, you're laughing over there. You might not be mean, but you've got to be transparent. This is all about inclusivity. So my job is always to keep a safe space, to deal with the bullies, to deal with the people who are stopping the space feel safe. So all those things are constant in my mind.
And do you find you apply your presence work in your daily life as well?
I do have to switch off, you see. You do feel that you have to space out.
Fair.
I think when it matters, I'm annoying to a lot of people because I don't like spending time. This is my, maybe it's called arrogance. I don't think it is exactly arrogance, but I've been called arrogant in my youth because I'm not really interested in talking about things that I think are not very important. I'm not very good at certain parties. I find I am shy. I'm very shy. I can do it. I can talk to people. I can listen. I can get them speaking if I bring my full presence. But if I don't want to bring my full presence, I think I'm not a very pleasant guest. I have to switch on in order to do it. But I did say recently, and it was an awful thing to say, and I really apologize, but I was sitting with some people who were just talking about their nails. Now, I don't mind talking about nails for 10 minutes, the nail polish, but 2 hours of it seems, particularly at my age, a waste of my life.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And trying to get them to change their mind. So I think in that way, people might call me a pain in the bum. I don't want to terrify them. I've had to work very hard in my life because I do work hard, but I've also able to say something terrible to someone. And when I was taught at Central, it was a very hard training. It was cruel. People said very awful things to people that, and I knew that that was wrong. So I've had to train myself not to say those things. I sometimes feel this great burst of energy when I think to myself, I could just say something to you now that would hurt you. And I've done that in my life, and I apologize. I've done it, but it's wrong.
Yeah.
I know it's wrong. I still see teachers doing it. If they're one of my teachers, I will be very angry with them. But these are things that we have to work on ourselves every day of our lives. Every human being does, but artists even more so. Artists have to work on themselves, know thyself.
Socrates.
Constantly, constantly, constantly.
What advice would you give to your younger self? Would you wish you would have known in your 20s, 30s?
To trust. To have faith and trust that the work will get you there. I've been called by lots of people ambitious, and because I got a lot of success very early in my life, I've suffered very viscerally from envy. All I can say about myself, I'm not really defending myself, but I trust the work. What I mean by that is you don't have to prove what you know it. I would tell myself that. I would tell myself that you don't have to win every battle. You don't have to win an argument. The great moment I remember, I was in my late 20s, standing in front of a group, and I can remember it was in the Guildhall, the old building, and I suddenly thought, oh, it's all right not to know. You can say to someone, I don't know. And then, of course, if you read the Hippocratic Oath, which is 5,000 years old, to doctors, the center of it is admit when you don't know. If leaders could now learn that we don't know. So I would have asked myself to admit that more, although I knew I should. I don't know. I better go and I'll look it up. I'll come back to you. So I would say that. And I would say, trust the work. I say to people all the time, trust the work. I know I've done the work. I know I've worked my guts out at what I've done. I mean, the early teaching, I was teaching 80 hours a week. I believe in knowing the work. But I think maybe I was a bit too pushy. And I'm not ambitious. I've only asked for one job in my life. Everything else has come to me. I haven't been ambitious. But I think people throw that as a criticism at me without realizing that I've done the work and not speak until you know more deeply. That would be my other. Don't try and skid over things that you don't know, not only in your teaching, but in life. You just should have to go and, Isabella says in Measure for Measure, you've got to knock on your heart. You've got to knock on your heart and go, I don't really know that. And you've got to admit it. In relationships, in family. I was very proud that my son once said about me, well, the good thing is that she always admits when she doesn't know. Now that he this godsend, this wonderful baby came into my life. He's not my biological child, but he came when I was 50. And I think I'm glad, obviously I would have liked to be able to run around with him more, but I was probably more able to say to him, I don't know.
It's such a funny thing, is that it's so difficult for people to say that. Again, it's because people are scared of seeming to be ignorant or stupid by saying, I don't know. But actually, it's such a powerful thing to say, I don't know.
It is. And the root word of arrogance in Latin means I have no questions. So arrogance is, I don't think I was ever arrogant because I've always had questions, but I think I could have handled it, my knowledge better, the bits that I did know. That's been a failure. But I know we, every day of our life we make a mistake. And the idea that we're not is terrifying to me.
Yeah, of course. And also by saying I don't know, in a way there's an ingrained curiosity in that. So you want to find out. Yeah. If you say I don't know, it means you might want to find out. Which is ironically what's made us successful as the human monkey species, hasn't
yes.
it?
Yes, and yeah, it's also curiosity. What creativity is. Mm. Creativity is messy. Because you have to admit that you're going to fail. You have to admit that you don't know how to do that bit in the scene. You have to come off stage every night and go, I haven't got that bit yet. I wonder why. That I wonder why. As opposed to, yeah, I can go on, out on stage, perhaps, and just give it and I'm fine. There's an actor. There's some actors don't want to work with me because I keep on putting the bar up. I mean, I've had actors say to me, I can't bear working with you. Keep on asking more. And I said, well, I ask more of myself. And I think if we're doing a great play, not if we're doing not a very good play, it's so expansive. It's so deep, Shakespeare. It's so wide. We're never going to get to the end of it. So we keep on having to put up the bar.
How do you deal with envy?
Well, you just in the end have to ignore it because you can't deal with it. I mean, there are things that you're not in control of. Being liked is one of them. People, what is it? A great therapist friend of mine said, jealousy, you want to be like someone. Envy, you want to kill them. And you can't do, you've got to walk away. What I do in my life now, if somebody, you know, that what I can't bear is passive aggression.
Oh, yeah.
I can't bear it. That's why I liked you, because I like you, because you're not passive aggressive. You're very open. And I like that a lot. But you know, you know.
Which some people hate when you're direct.
I know, but
people
I
hate
don't,
that.
I don't mind that at all. I'd rather see what's there rather than a disguise.
Mm.
But people would sort of mumble under their breath at something passive-aggressively. And now I would just say, what did you say? If you've got something to say to me, say it. What did you say? So I don't think you can deal with it. But, you know, you can't deal with it by trying to combat it. And you can't deal with it by trying to make them like you. You just have to be authentic. Again, you have to own yourself. Shakespeare's Sonnet 94, you know, great leaders, they are the lords and owners of their faces. You just have to be, what, do you have a problem with that? You've just got to be direct. And particularly women, of course some men as well, but particularly women feel these things and don't say them soon enough. They don't say, excuse me, why are you speaking to me like that?
Yeah.
So you get women now shouting at them, but they've had opportunities. You know, I teach great women leaders. I say, if somebody interrupts you, you say immediately, please don't interrupt me. Before, but in fact, they fight it. The truth, the connection, be in the moment. Say what you have to say before it gets... You see, if you don't say it immediately, it festers in you. And by the time you do say it, if you're going to say to a student, and I've been teaching young people in Manchester, you know, 40, 11-year-olds, and generally I don't get discipline problems because as soon as somebody's out of order, I say, excuse me, what are you doing over there? And if you don't, A, the group goes, oh, thank God she knows the bully. But B, the bully knows they're being watched. And if I don't do it on the first, I will fester and then I'll be inappropriate. What are you doing? You know, I will do... It will fester. So as soon as somebody displays something negative towards you or is trying to disempower you or is trying to shut you down, mention it.
What would your main advice be to someone who'd like to succeed as a voice coach, director, actor?
Success needs extraordinarily hard work. You don't get a good voice. Let's talk about teaching. You can't do it by teaching 4 hours a week. It's a skill, it's a craft. You have to be an artisan. All these things, you need to work very hard. But also, let's get it in perspective. Not everybody wants to be a leader.
Yeah.
And you have to be honest with yourself. I love some of my best friends will say to me, fantastic actors, fantastic. And I'll say, why don't you play that big role? Oh, I don't want to. I just want two nice scenes. It's too hard. Don't believe that you can be a success. You know, great actors to do a major role. It's extraordinarily difficult. So it's honesty. Do I really want success, or am I just jealous of somebody being successful without putting in the work? I've said to people I trained with at Central, and I could feel that they were jealous. And I said, but you were in the bar every night. I went home.
Mm.
I went home and worked. But I think it's hard work. And you've got to know what you want to say. You've got to have a passion in your heart and your mind and your spirit. Why you want to be an artist? Is it because I just want to be famous? I've taught many, many Oscar winners. And quite frankly, you're standing there with that little statue. It's got a life, a shelf life of 18 months. You don't work to get fame. You work because you feel what you're doing matters. You feel as an actor that telling a great story matters. And I do believe that.
Mm.
So you have to be very honest with yourself. There are artists in the theatre, and then there are actors, what I call the teeth and tit brigade, the people who just want fame, and they will flirt with the audience. They won't do the play, they'll flirt with the audience. They think they're more important. Do you know who I am? You know, the great actors I know are the most generous people. It's not this idea we have of an artist being this narcissist. You know, you do a good piece of work with these great actors in the room, they'll get out of the chair, they'll walk across the room and say, well done.
Yeah.
And they will also, because if they're lead actors, will say to a young, rude actor, don't speak to the stage manager like that. We need everyone in this room. You're not more important than the stage manager, the deputy stage manager. You're not more important. So you've got to be honest. Have I worked hard enough? And people say, well, it's so hard. And I say, well, I've done so much unpaid work to find my... Don't chase the money, chase the knowledge.
Yeah.
Chase the knowledge. Chase... You put the phone down and you think, well, they're not going to pay me anything, but my God, I'm going to learn something here.
Oh, that's a really nice one. Yeah. Chase your curiosity and the knowledge instead of, yeah. It all boils down to hard work and...
honesty about what
vocation, the vocation. Strong why. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
I was just talking recently to my bank manager, and he has an assistant, which is a lovely young man. Well, he's in his 30s, and I won't give his name on the podcast. And he's so good. And I said to my banker, why is so and so just in that job? He's in such a small job. And he said, he doesn't want to be a top banker. What he wants is to go home with his wife, go to the pub and play billiards. That's his choice. All education is choice.
And it's also okay.
Absolutely.
Not everyone has to be, yeah.
It's okay, but you can't say I haven't had the opportunity if you don't work and seek it. And of course the fates intervene. That we can't control whether you get the most amazing job, but my God, if you get it, then you have to honor that and work to achieve it. I will never leave a room, I'm sure I have in the past, but I hope never to leave a room with anyone in without doing my best to teach them and transform them. I do not give up on any of my students. I get very angry when I hear teachers saying, oh, well, I've given up on that person. And I say, that's not your right to give up on anyone. I mean, I get into terrible spats with teachers. Why are you spending so much time on that student? Because it's our job to do our best for everyone that we work with.
I have to say, you have this gift of making people feel special when you work with them.
But everyone is special.
Yeah. And I think that is important.
It's
no, but not everyone does that. That's what I mean. I read this quote the other day again where a guy said, you're more powerful than you think you are. And I really like that because it's so easy in life to feel you're like powerless, you know, because there's so much luck involved in the industry and in life in general. But there's so much more we can do, you know. And by giving someone the feeling that they're special, because we all are special, and we're all enough, no matter what we do, we're enough. Of course, we have to work hard, but I think the essence in us is just enough. And to like realize that and know that there's a responsibility there and a power we can access in order to do what we really love doing, I think that is a big thing.
Well, I'm now going to say something that you might not like, which is, I don't mind if my students don't become actors or directors or writers. As long as they work, the work that we do together will make them good at something that they want. And sometimes the world that they're entering is just too uncomfortable for them. You know, if you play a major role on, say, Broadway, I've just put a leading diva on stage, gorgeous woman. And to do that role, you give up, you sign away your life for a year. You can't go out late at night to do it correctly. But I think honesty, we just have to be honest with each other and just go, I don't want to work this hard. You just have to be honest. And there's no judgment. I have no judgment. If somebody said to me, students say, I don't want to do Shakespeare, I'll say, fine. But just find out what the craft might be that you learn. I don't want to do theatre. Fine, I don't mind if you don't want to do theatre, but just see what this can give you. It's your choice. It's all about your choice. But I think people have to realise that it is a choice.
And it also lies within the definition of this glib word, success. Because what is success for you, right? Like, success for you can be to have a garden and have a dog and have a family. And that is fine. Like we said before, not everyone has to strive to, you know, be successful in the what society calls successful.
Absolutely. I like the quote, I'm going to get it wrong, from Maya Angelou, but people will remember you by how you make them feel. But you see, let's go political again, because we've been ruled on the planet by people who are narcissists, who are not serving anything but themselves, who don't believe in the truth, who don't believe in self-knowledge, who are pleased that they're dumb. And we now have to break through. I have to say, can I just say to young people out there, what I mean by that, people in their, well, up to 20, you know, in their 20s and earlier, I am more optimistic about the planet because of the young people I'm now teaching. There was a whole period in the 80s and 90s when people were not political. They just laughed. They rolled their eyes when I said feminism. And suddenly, the great gift that I'm seeing in young people is that they're doing what I always say to people. You know, I've never discovered anything. Everything I teach, we all know. I just try to bring it to consciousness. But we know that being decent to each other is better than not being decent.
Mm.
Being a community, even though we might not like certain people in the community and we might have a spat with them every now and then, that's fine. But as a group, we are trying to do our best. And that has been not in the zeitgeist. And suddenly it is. So we have hope. And all I can say is I will die in harness, trotting along, pulling a cart, if I'm of use. And I hope to be of use.
How do you let go of the need to control in all this hard work?
That's a very good question. Well, people have better ideas than you, and you have to accept it. And if you're over-controlling, you see, there's a balance here. It's, you know, everything I do in my presence work is about balance.
Yeah.
It's what the Renaissance was about, between the mind and the heart. Balance. We've gone all into the mind and we've got to rebalance to the heart. Control is force. If we believe fundamentally that even if I'm leading you, that we're all equal, there is no control. There is absolutely a group decision to let the work happen. And if one person is not allowing that work to happen, the leader then has to stop that. So it's, you're not controlling for your sake, you're controlling for the group's sake. And when an ensemble or a community works very well, the community deals with it. The community rebalances. And it's not a control, it's the well-being of the group. It's the well-being. If you're crossing the Kalahari, walking across in that sun, and somebody is not pulling their weight or offering, it doesn't mean to say you can be carried, but then you might have to tell a good story at the end of the day. An artist might be carried because they're not very strong, but they have to contribute. And I was working with a bushman and he laughed. He said, what do you do if somebody doesn't carry their weight? We leave them. We leave them, which is a terrible idea for me. But I don't leave people, but if people can't, if people are not generous and are destroying the work of others, somebody has to control them. But it's not about controlling when the work is going well. We enter a space. I think we need much more ritual. I talk a lot about ritual, even in the leadership world. You sit, everyone has to become present. You have to put your phones away. You have to make eye contact. We need ritual.
Do you have a ritual for your own, like, say you want to control an outcome? Do you have a ritual to let go? Is there anything you do?
Well, I think you just, yes, you have to let go at some point. No, it's very hard, isn't it? Depends how much you, your love is involved. And the control that you have is about an oath you make. It's like in a marriage. These are the oaths that I make. So we have to understand why we've met and what we're doing together. So control is contained. That's why I love verse. I love verse and poetry because the form contains the mess. The mess of to be or not to be is contained in the form. And in a way, the world has gone too casual. People think I'm being a bit pompous when I say form. We're formal with each other. That doesn't mean to say we're pompous, but we have to give each other space and presence. And agree not to control each other, but to try and grow each other. The good of the group, the good of the family.
And letting go of control is probably connected to breath in a way, isn't it?
Body and breath. Taking a full breath, taking a full low breath.
Do you meditate?
I have forms that I do, yes.
Do you want to share them?
No, I don't particularly.
Okay.
I don't particularly. No, because I mean, we allowed our secrets.
Oh yeah, of course.
We're allowed. I have an otherness about the work I do, but I don't. Number one, I don't want to take that into a room because I don't feel that. What is my contract? I'm always I talk to teachers all the time. What is your contract? You don't go into a room to teach an actor. Yeah. Spiritual practices. They've come to learn about their body, their presence, their voice, their breath. So your contract. And I think a lot of teachers cross that boundary of contract. I know I have, probably.
Uh-huh. So you'd say they teach what they're not there to do.
Yes. I always say to American actors, and they look at me in shock, you don't have to tell me everything about yourself until you trust me. You don't have to reveal yourself.
That's interesting.
You have to trust. My job is to not get you weeping in front of a group. Or I say to every group I ever work with outside the Guildhall, you only tell me what you feel you want to tell me and the group. And that goes down very badly in some circumstances because, you know, and some students say, I want to tell you all about when this happened. And that's, what is your contract? I wouldn't stop somebody doing that. But we are here to meet, to do a play. Now, when I work with certain groups that are doing something else, maybe that is my contract. to talk about my practice.
What unpopular beliefs do you hold? Where would you say you diverge from the crowd in theatre-making life?
My thing is about deep knowledge, and I think the world we're living in is about surface knowledge. So people talk. Everyone is allowed to give an opinion, but I do find all I can say about myself is I don't give an opinion until I've really thought about it or read about it deeply. So deep knowledge, I don't like people spouting stuff that they haven't really examined. And I might say I strongly suspect. I don't think I am right and I'm right is useful, but I don't feel people spouting at stuff that they have no context. I believe in context. I believe in a deep, deep knowledge of something. And of course, you never know everything. But people saying to me things that are wrong and untruthful, and they quote back at me that they've read it here or there. And that's fashionable, you see. I don't think, in a way, I don't blame people, but that's what they're hearing Trump do. We're hearing people spout things. And that's when you have to have humility. I like the word humility. That's a very I think the words that I like that are very unfashionable. Decency. You've got to be decent to each other.
Mm.
I like the idea of manners, not prescribed manners. I think, you know, you have to teach people, but I think it's very rude to be late. I don't necessarily say that to a student immediately, but I think those things are unfashionable because you're not thinking of the other person. Manners is only being present to somebody and thinking of their point of view. And I think, gravitas is important. You can't laugh at everything. That makes me very upset, that people just laugh at everything. There's mocking and joking. I knew we were in for a very tough time with Trump when, whatever you think about Senator John McCain, he did fight for his country, whether you believe that or not. And he was imprisoned and tortured. And when Trump said, "I don't like losers," and he got a laugh, I thought that is a terrible thing that is so fashionable, that we laugh at people and it's mocking and debilitating. So I don't like those things.
Also, what you said before about opinions, I feel like you have to do your homework in order to have an opinion, because it's so easy to say, "Oh, it's just my opinion." But have you actually looked at the facts? Have you actually checked? Have you looked at it from different perspectives?
And the personal experience is extraordinarily important. In fact, when I was a child, it was the other way around. You know, there's a pendulum that swings. When I was a child, nobody asked me how I feel. It was all about your knowledge, what you've read. And of course it swung. I mean, I know I upset students sometimes when we're looking at a poem. I know I upset them, and I warn them, "I'm going to upset you. This is what the poem makes me feel." And I will say, "Good, I'm glad you're feeling, but can we now look at about what the poem is really about and what was being felt by the writer rather than what you feel about it?" And that is about humility. That's I was touching the word humility. We have to be humble. We have to go, "I don't understand this. I mean, there's certain things I don't understand yet. I'm trying. And some of those things would make me seem very rigid, but it's not that I'm rigid. I just don't understand." And that's unfashionable.
What would you say is your greatest failure, and what did you learn from it?
I think I fail every day. I think I now know those failures. I've failed a couple of times badly in protecting a student, and that I still worry about those students, and some of them I've talked to about it, but years later, you know, the space isn't secure and safe enough, and somebody does an amazing piece of work, and then a student just says something so horrendous to them that you can see them. So you fail those things. You fail in positions of power to be responsible at certain points. Maybe you've done the challenges privately and not publicly. You fail on those things. And I think I fail sometimes by taking people for granted.
In your life?
Yes, I think so.
It's a big thing, isn't it?
It's big.
Because it ties to mortality, doesn't it? And
it's a time and mortality. Mm. It's not like one of the big sins of, you know, but it's about, you know, for somebody who teaches presence, not to sometimes be present enough with somebody you love feels a terrible thing. You know, your child, your moments when you should have just not been rushing. And with students, that you just suddenly haven't got time.
It's time. I feel a mental model that I find very helpful is that you can always have more money, you can always have more success, you can always have more land or property, but you'll never, never have more time. And that is what people, I feel like we don't understand, is that, you know, every second's passing. And it can also be a very positive thing to realize that and be like, oh, it's precious. I need to make use of it and do what I really want to do. So,
Yes, and time, it comes down to these, you know, I've often tried to explain to students that they have to be on time. And of course, you have to understand that some of them have never had that explained to them. So you've got to do it very gently. You can't just keep on. At the Guildhall, when I went there, the procedure was you lock the door at 9 and people can't come into the class. And that seemed too rigid to me. That was how I was trained. The door was locked. But of course, some people are having huge problems getting there. So you've got to be more open. And then you see people take advantage of that. But the moment I really shifted one student years ago, and he was on the verge of being thrown out because of timekeeping. This is some years ago. And everybody had tried everything. And then we forget the simple thing. And I don't think I planned it, but he came in late again and he looked at me thinking, oh my God, I'm in trouble. And I just said, you see, when you're not with us, we miss you. We miss you. And suddenly he understood that he mattered. He was not. So sometimes you just have to hope that you get inspiration from some higher place. But just that idea of keeping somebody waiting.
That's so lovely because it's so gentle as well.
Well, we try and do it. You try and do it gently. And it was, that's a pattern I had to break in not only myself, but in the way that I was taught. This isn't working. This might work with people who, but not everybody has been taught punctuality. My father taught me punctuality.
Oh, it's a habit you can train, yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
Is there anything you used to believe strongly that you've changed your mind on recently, in the last few years?
I know in teaching they're rather boring things. I used to say things that I know now that were wrong to teach. I mean, not complex things. You know, I used to say, oh, just get this voice for when you rehearse and perform, as opposed to find the whole voice, because the voice would always be put on. There's definitely changes that I think, there's sometimes I think I can't teach that exercise for whatever reason again, and I've got a better one. But actually, philosophically, I came from my father was a warrior and was a very difficult man. And it wasn't an easy ride for me. But it's true, you just have to forgive. As opposed to fight. Let's get it a bit easier, maybe. You have to get, forgiveness is so hard. But you have to let go of things. You have to go, okay, I can't win this one. You know, I can't make this person love me. I mustn't seek to hurt this person. And that has taken a lot of release in oneself. But it's the only way, is to release those things.
How do you forgive?
I think it starts with seeing their point of view. I remember realizing that my father had starved and had been shot at, and at the age of 16, and then the war ended. Nobody gave him counseling. Nobody said, you're stressed. And context, it's about history. It's about the young man coming into the room, and you realize nobody, all we've done is to tell him off and send him notes about punctuality. Nobody has said to him, your presence is so wonderful in the room that we don't feel complete until you're there. That somehow you have to do a 360 in your brain and look around every corner of your relationship with someone.
Yeah.
And it's hard. And you've got to... It's Hamlet, the first soliloquy, when you feel in grief, he's coming back to his body, oh, that this too solid flesh. He's beginning to feel again. You know, when you have grief, as you know, you go numb. And you have to come back to your life. And you've got to come back to feeling. And sometimes it takes that long for oneself to feel where somebody is, because we're not feeling. Our failure is making it impossible for them to feel safe with us, because we're not feeling appropriately. So it's the life journey. It's the pilgrimage, isn't it? We're all on a pilgrimage. We never get there. We never get there. You don't think, oh, now I've got there. Now I understand Shakespeare. You never get there.
And you better start loving the journey, don't you?
Yes, don't be a theatre actor if you're standing in the wings going, I don't want to go on. That's what I always say. Maybe I've said it to some very top A-list celebrities who wanted to be put on stage. And I said, I can't mention their names, but I said, you know, you're never going to do this work because you don't want to go on. You know, you've got to be standing in the wings thinking, wow, I've got a great story. I want to go on. And if you don't want to do that, then don't be a theatre actor. If you don't want to play with other people, if you don't want to share energy, if you want to be the centre of attraction and not give space to someone else on the stage, don't be a theatre actor. You can make a lot more money being centre stage. You don't need to turn up to do scenes with people because there'll be a stand-in. If that's who you are, don't try and go on stage. Because let's talk now, lastly maybe, about the audience. We have to be generous to the audience. Why would they come back? Why will they come back into the theatre if they can't hear us, if you're not present, if you don't bring them into an awakening place?
Oh, yeah.
Presence. You know, let's talk about why we do this, which is the audience. And the audience wants to come because they want to be changed and transformed and to think differently and change the world differently. So if you don't want to be generous, if you don't want to be generous to your fellow actors, if you don't want to be generous to the theatre and the audience coming in, if you don't want to be heard and clear and tell a story with connection and passion, don't be a theatre actor.
Yeah. You have to, you have to love the audience. You have to love this energy that's coming from them. And it doesn't mean that you're not nervous. You can still be nervous. I'd rather call it excited. It's the same kind of energy.
Well, there's an adrenaline changing your body. You've got to learn how to breathe through it. You've got to stay connected. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to like it.
Yeah.
But they're going to be, they'll have an experience. It's better that they have an experience and go out, oh, I hated that, than going out going, oh, that was all right.
Oh, yeah. I like the word you used. You used to make them feel alive.
Aliveness.
Also, I love how you bring everything back to Shakespeare. So why is Shakespeare important, Patsy?
Because he's, in my mind, an extraordinary human being. I don't know, again, Maya Angelou said, when I first read, I'm going to paraphrase it, but she said, in essence, when I first read Shakespeare, I thought he must be an 11-year-old black girl. He manages. I don't know. People say, how did he do it? I don't know how he did it. But maybe he was just in contact with something.
Yeah.
How does he understand exactly how all these people feel? And then the great gift is he tells the truth. And he doesn't let us be sentimental, But he, in the end, seeks redemption. He seeks forgiveness. Not all. One of the reasons why Othello is such a hard play is that the villain, Iago, never apologises. Every other villain apologises. It's that serial killer going to the lethal injection, not saying I'm sorry. And that is devastating. And but in his view, he looks at it all with such specificity and clarity, and then he's seeking characters' redemption and their enlightenment. If you're going to marry this man, who might look, I'm talking about Portia in Merchant of Venice and Bassanio, so marry him. He's gorgeous looking. He's fantastic. He's charming. His body is exquisite. But you should know that he has lied to you. Go into the marriage. Maybe that's a better marriage than going in thinking he's a great man. And he has to marry her knowing that dressed as a man, he's more intelligent. She's more intelligent. So it's hard. It's a hard journey he takes us on, but it's an honourable journey, and it's a journey into the truth and into human connection through unconditional love.
What are your plans for the future? What are the main things on your bucket list now?
Well, I'm going to open my own centre where I'm going to build and have actors come and reconnect to ensemble, and leaders come and work with actors to find out the skills that actors have. Great leaders need all the research they're now doing in business schools is that the leaders now need they need facts to begin with, but if they're going to be leaders they have to have presence and creativity. Yeah. I'm going to teach teachers this work so it can go to schools. I'm going to teach anyone who wants to come to the center, but it's going to be about storytelling and the humanities, so they'll learn how to use their presence, their voice, structure, language. It's going to teach equal debate, discussion and debate. It's all 45 years of my life coming into a centre.
Nice. I'm also going to put a link to all your books in the show notes for people to find. They're all great. I find especially your last book, Presence, I find that very, in a way, it's advice for life on how to interact with people.
I would say try Presence, but I've got a book coming out on the woman's voice.
Ah.
And that should come out next year. And it's about my journey to find my voice, but my concern about women's voices at this moment.
Is that the book you're writing right now?
Yes, it's nearly finished.
Oh, nice. And where can people find you? What's the best way to get in touch with you? Or just the email. There's an email on your website.
Yes.
I think that's the easiest way.
Yes, that's the easiest way.
Any parting words, last thoughts you'd like to share with our audience?
Enjoy the journey and do the work. Take a step at a time. Seek the simple before you seek the profound.
Ah, nice. Great. Thanks so much, Patsy.
Thanks, Michael. You were great. You did a very wonderful job. Thank you. I felt in the hands of a professional, and my God, many a interviewer hasn't been as professional as you are.
That was very kind of you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure as well.
Thank you for listening. If you find this podcast valuable, there are many ways you can support it. You can leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you happen to listen to it, and you can share it on social media. It really does help other listeners find us. And make sure to subscribe to get the next episode. Thanks so much for your support.